Hey, Black and Published family, it's Nikisha. I want to say thank you for rocking with me these last few years. Over the course of these 5 seasons, I've shared with you the journeys of countless writers, including myself. I've told you about starting out as a self-published author and when my first nonfiction book came out in 2022. I have a new novel coming out in January entitled The 7 Daughters of Dupree. The story is a generational epic about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of 7 generations, told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860, and it's available for pre-order now, everywhere you get your books. I am beyond excited for this novel. It is my first Big 5 book, more on that later, and I'd like to make it a success, and I need your help to do that. If you can, please consider pre-ordering The 7 Daughters of Dupree today. Now let's get to the episode.
I was one of those people that wanted trad publishing, but I wasn't ready for that world, nor did I know the actual story that I actually wanted to write until self-publishing allowed me to get there.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published on the Mahogany Book Podcast Network, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Rachel Housel Hall, author of the new thriller, Fog and Fury. The publication of this book marks 23 years since Rachel's publishing debut, a time span that includes a 10-year break from traditional publishing, while also staring death in the face.
So here I am at 37, talking about my mortality. And so I was like, if we're talking about living and dying, what are those things that I want to do before I die? And one of those was writing the book that I wanted to write. I've done the scary thing. The scary thing was fighting cancer. And so I had no bucks to give.
With nearly 25 years and more than 15 books deep, Rachel says that it is her respect for the craft, its creators, and the industry at all levels that keeps her going. Why she says it's important for authors to know and lean into their brand. Plus, what she found to be the true secret sauce to go from writer to published author. And the reason she says, even when you achieve all your writer dreams, your life still doesn't change. That and more is next, when Black and Published continues. Rachel, when did you know that you were a writer?
I knew that I was a writer pretty early on. I didn't know that it was like a job, but I was the kid who liked writing on church bulletins. I was the kid who would find joy in encyclopedias, and I kept a journal from, I think it was like third or fourth grade onto maybe my second year out of college. But it wasn't until after college, and I worked at an organization called Penn Center West, and it was a group of professional writers fighting for the rights of others. So it's basically like Amnesty International. And that's when I saw my first working writers who were just like me, but actually wrote and published books. And there were actually a few Black writers, Phoebe Moore Campbell, for example, who I'd met. And it's like, you actually get to do this thing called writing. It wasn't like something over there at East Coast and you have to be very important, like Alice Walker and Toni Morrison. You could actually write like contemporary stories about like people like us. And that's when I started really working towards publishing a novel.
What year was that?
I started working at Penn in 1996, and my first novel was published the first anniversary of 9/11. So September 11th, 2002. Yeah.
That's a date you'll never forget.
Not ever. Not ever.
So then what did that do for you, being able to see authors out in the wild, as you say, to bolster you toward something that you've always done, but like making it a career?
It just made it accessible. That there was no secret sauce and secret handshake. I mean, in some circles there is, but the circle that Phoebe Moore Campbell and Jervy Turvillon and Gary Phillips, all these incredible Black writers were just doing the work. And back then, you know, hoping to land the agent and a great publisher, but they were still writing and talking to each other. Community was a part of that secret sauce, the recommending agents to each other and writing contests and being asked to read at certain events. That was something that I didn't know was a part of learning the art of writing and hearing about the things that would get you published and get your book out there.
Okay. So I honed in on the word secret sauce. So we're going to go there for a while. You say there's no secret sauce to like becoming a published author, but I think what mystifies so many aspiring writers is that there does seem to be the secret sauce trajectory of MFA,
Marquee. Which I don't have.
Me either. Like MFA, Marquee Writers Conferences, yeah, or residencies, agent, book deal.
Yeah.
And over the years of doing this podcast, some Black writers have gone that route. Some have completely eschewed it. Mm-hmm. Some have started on that route and then eschewed it.
Yeah.
And the answer has always come back down to community.
Yeah.
You've been doing this for 20 some odd years.
Yep.
How important has community been to being the only ingredient that matters in your writing and publishing career?
That is so important, and I'm glad we're talking about it. One, community helps you know that, yes, you write a book alone, but you are not alone in this, and that you're not being weird if you want to spend all day writing or reading or going somewhere and studying. Community will tell you that that agent over there is not worth it, or that contest, don't do that. Community will say, get your butt in the seat and write. Community will say, yeah, I got a full-time job and I'm a mom and I write. Community will call you on your mess and also celebrate you when, you know, your small wins. Not every win is huge, but it's that encouragement, that saying that this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. And like you just said, I've been doing this for a very long, long time. And I know a lot of people, but I still have this core group that I actually turned to yesterday for some drama thing that, you know, says, you're not crazy. This was wrong, or this is exciting, or have you thought of taking that story that you not really like doing well on? Have you thought about that plot or that kind of character? You need as much encouragement and atta girls as possible, especially now. Now more than ever, you need like one or two or three or 20 other people saying that, yeah, there's a lot to write about. And yeah, it's okay if you can't do it right now, but you need to do something. This is what we do. So yeah, I think people wanting to go it alone and being a maverick and, you know, saying, screw y'all, I got this over here. I think that's a dangerous thing to do. I mean, good luck, go all and do that. But those people who have longevity in this have a group of people who are there for them, and they're there for them.
In your writing, was it always contemporary genre fiction that you were focused on? Or did you just want to write whatever kind of story that you came up with?
I wanted to write whatever initially, because my interests were all over the place. Like, I still have my Scholastic Book Fair purchases over in my library, and that was my first was Ramona the Brave, Beverly Cleary. So I always like strong characters, strong female characters. But then, you know, I read Stephen King growing up. I loved Jackie Collins and Sidney Sheldon. So I was definitely into genre. But then you get to college and you start reading, you know, the important books, capital I, important books. And, you know, if you're around writing organizations, you do get that you have to have an MFA and you have to read the canon. And that's where you're like, as a writer, okay, maybe I do have to sound like the next generation's Toni Morrison and write about these big, big, big ideas and use all the symbolism. And I tried that, at least I thought I was trying that, and it wasn't working because that was never me. My heart was in the genres over there and suspense and all that. And so my first book, I aimed for you know, literary fiction, but it still had tinges of psychological suspense and murder and all that. And, you know, it did well, but this was also the time when Sister Souljah and Omar Tyree and all this very East Coast kind of centric so-called urban literature was being published. And for many publishers and editors, my voice, you know, me being from Los Angeles, it wasn't considered Black enough. So, you know, that made me say, well, what is it that I want to write? And me not being able to get a second book deal and going through life experiences in my 30s helped me get closer and closer to that. And that was writing mystery thriller suspense with those strong female characters, with that sense of place. I love Los Angeles. I'm a native and I am ride and die for the city. And those were the stories I wanted to write. And sometimes they weren't true mysteries, but they were thriller, but they were suspense. So they were all in that kind of category. And I was fine with that, actually. I love this space. And I've branched out to, you know, write romantasy right now. But even my romantasy has that still that strong kind of red herrings and twists and cliffhangers and all that kind of thing. So it's not a pure kind of romantasy. I like the idea of putting women, especially Black women, in spaces where the majority in that surrounding, in that setting, finds her intrusive, finds her to be a problem. So I like that space, and that's mystery, and that's thriller and suspense. And I do that with all of my stories that I've written, and so far it's been 15. It's this kind of telling.
So let's talk about this industry right fast.
Uh-huh.
And you saying that you didn't fit that East Coast urban fiction narrative and had a time trying to get your second book deal. After being able to secure the first and then having that, I guess, I don't know if it was devastation, but I'm going to call it devastation.
It was.
What kept you going in the industry that was rejecting you so soon after they had accepted you?
Yeah. Stubbornness, for one. You're not going to tell me no. And this is the thing I do. I do this. I can't add well. I write. And when A Quiet Storm was published, the people who did read it, especially the Black audience, they loved it. They appreciated it. And many people who live in Los Angeles and in California, they appreciated finally reading a story about their neighborhoods and their life in Southern California. You know, a lot of times people will read LA novels and it's always like, I say, north of the 10 freeway. It's always like Kim Kardashian's LA. It's Beverly Hills and Santa Monica and Hollywood. It's never the Crenshaw area or Watts or Compton or any of those. And for many readers who did read A Quiet Storm, seeing their Black Los Angeles, they were so appreciative and excited to read that. And that kept me going because we do have stories here. And we do have people on the other side of the world who want to read our stories about being Black in Los Angeles. So it was that, those two things, knowing that there was an audience for my stories, for one. And two, just being told no when I knew that no one gets to tell me no, especially about something as important as books. And if that means me waiting and living life and experiencing things that only make my writing richer, I will wait. And I use that time between not landing a second book deal and finally landing another book deal. That was 2003 to 2013. I had our only child, our daughter. I became a cancer survivor. I changed jobs. I wrote two self-published novels that got me closer and closer to that thing that I actually wanted to write, which was Waiting to Exhale meets Walter Mosley's Devil in a Blue Dress. That was Land of Shadows. And so I look at it as kind of like a cicada in a way, where I was burrowing underground for all that time, learning, living, and being wrecked physically, and finding faith, and being a new mother and a professional, and all these things that help writers become versed in the world and learning how to record that and put it on page. It took a moment, but it was worth it. I don't think a writer can ever be bored, right? Because we're constantly learning. Everything we read just lodges in our brain. We learn new tricks We read writers we admire and those books that aren't really all that great to learn how to do what we do. And, you know, of course, in all that time, I broke up with my first agent and then I landed some more and broke up with them because they couldn't sell what I was trying to write either. And in that time, Amazon came out with the self-publishing platform. So it wasn't time wasted. It was just time for me to do a lot of living.
So then in all of that living and all of that life thing, congratulations on surviving cancer.
Thank you.
Did that experience make you even more stubborn to continue doing something that you love and not taking no for an answer because it's like, I just survived cancer, fuck you.
Well, that's what it was. And that's exactly why I wrote Land of Shadows, because at that point, I was 37, and UCLA, my care team, when I was pregnant with my daughter, that's when they discovered the first lump in my breast. The estrogen was what made it grow, because back then in 2002, 2003, they weren't giving mammograms to young women because what was the need? And so when they did discover it, because the estrogen made something tiny, tiny, tiny grow, they kept watch over me. And, you know, I had my biggest surgery at 6 months when I was 6 months pregnant.
Mm.
They kept watching me and kept watching me, and other precancerous growths come and they cut those out. And at 37, they finally put me in the high risk program where I was on tamoxifen, which is a chemotherapy, for 5 years. So here I am at 37 talking about my mortality. And so I was like, if we're talking about living and dying, what are those things that I want to do before I get out of here, before I die? And one of those, and people have heard me say this before, one, I wanted a Mercedes-Benz because that was going to be my 50th birthday gift to myself, was going to be that Benz. And so I got that Benz because it's like, I may not see 50. And then the second was writing the book that I wanted to write. And that was Waiting to Excel meets Devil in a Blue Dress, because I'd never written a true police procedural before. I wasn't a cop, but I'm like, well, I've done the scary thing, and the scary thing was fighting cancer. And so I had no fucks to give. And I just started writing because I'd done the scared thing. I'd done the fear thing. What's the worst that can happen, you know? And so I wrote it. And that's when I landed a new agent who I've been with since then. That's when I got the book deal with Forge for 2 books and then 2 more books. And I've been writing a book every year since then. Now 2 books a year since then. It was that fear that released me and that stubbornness that, well, if I'm going, I'm going to do what I need to do to get out of here. And now I'm doing what I need to do to set my daughter up for life. And if royalties are going to help her live a good life, then we're going to do that too.
First of all, this might be inappropriate to say, but for a cancer survivor, your hair is glorious. Like, these edges are thriving. I'm loving it.
Thank you. I need to get them. They're like gray.
It's like, I'm like, no, that it's fucking fine. It's getting natural edges and glorious, right?
Thank you.
So then what did it mean to you after realizing you had done the hard thing, you were facing death, and you left in her face and in the publishing industry's face by writing the book that you always wanted to write? What did it mean to you to have that come out, and what was the reception?
It was gratifying, but part of my problem is, and I'm working on this, I don't stop long enough to celebrate. So it's like, this is awesome. Next, you know, that kind of thing. You are that type.
Yes, like, I am you and you are me and we are the
same. Yes. And it's like, you're checking boxes because you got to keep going and you appreciate it. You love it. But I am learning to slow down and look around and say, this is really, really cool. I got to do that when we went on vacation to kind of enjoy the fruits of my labor. My family has helped me do that more, to say, take a moment and just sit with that and realize that this is a pretty big accomplishment. I tend to downplay that and forget that. And I'm learning at 55. I actually keep on my desk a wind jar. And whenever I experience a win, that could be something small as, you know, I did a podcast today. I'll put that in my thing. So being on Good Morning America for Margaret Romanesi, that goes in my win jar, because there are moments, as you know, where you're sitting in the silence and it's like, what have I even done? Why can't I have her success? You know, there's always someone that you're, you know, gunning for that type of success. And you feel like crap. But this win jar that I keep is a reminder that I've actually done some things this year. And at the end of every year, I put my wins for the year into a baggie and label it, and I put it in my desk and start a new jar. And even if I never look at those wins again, I know in those moments where I'm thinking I've done nothing and that I've accomplished nothing, I'm lying to myself. My brain is telling me something that is not true.
I think I'm going to start doing that.
You should do it. It feels great.
Since 2013, a book a year to two books a year, you have seen the industry change in so many ways. When you talk about Amazon launching what was then CreateSpace, mm-hmm. that's what I started self-publishing.
Yes.
Before it became Kindle Direct Publishing, and all the different self-publishing arms that have come out, from iBooks to Books a Million and Kobo and all these different things, even seeing the traditional industry change so radically.
Yeah.
How have you been able to navigate those changes, but also staying true to your style and your stories and your home?
I think, one, I've learned, having done both now, respect is key to all of it. There are some trad published authors who dismiss self-publishing. And for me, a great story is a great story. And I want it, no matter how it comes to me, I want it. And I respect the motor that brings it to my phone or to my hands. And also the creator. What we do, you know, it's not coal mining, but it's hard. I respect the creators of these stories who have this drive to tell a story that hasn't been told. And to understand that I was one of those people that wanted trad publishing, but I wasn't ready for that world, nor did I know the actual story that I actually wanted to write until self-publishing allowed me to get there. So I understand the struggle, and I respect the struggle and the hustle. To market on your own, that is a lot of work. And I'm not interested in doing all that kind of work. So for someone, I go to all these cons, and especially in the romantasy world, where these independent published authors have such a massive following and all the merch and all this stuff. It's like, girl, I respect you for just the hustle of that and the knowledge that is required to even do this successfully. So I never forget me in that space, flapping around and trying to figure it out, but also knowing that you have to be nimble and you have to have people, and this is where community comes in. You have to have people who know more than you around you, because those people who know more than you will tell you what they know. And you soon come into the knowledge of, oh, I need to do this, 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 and this to have people receive my books. So that, staying nimble, being open to suggestions, being open to community and people who know more than you, but also knowing what my brand is and being okay with my brand. My brand is, like I said, sending women of color, Black women, into spaces where they are seen as disruptors and upsetting the status quo around them and having them, you know, find out who they are as they're uncovering shenanigans in a town or a setting. That's my brand. When readers pick up my book, they don't know how I'm going to jack up their world, but they do know that my character will be her. It's going to be my daughter or me in this story. So heeding and acknowledging my brand is one thing that I learned how to do. And finally, kind of just being a consumer of information. So being open and reading and consuming helps with story ideas.
You said that between your first book and Land of Shadows, that you had to find out whether or not you were ready for traditional publishing. What did you mean by that? Mm-hmm. And how did you know that you were ready? Like, are you ready now?
You know, I don't think I'm ever writing, even with 15 books, every time I start a project, it's like, do I even know how to do this? So it's that kind of confidence that kind of comes when I'm looking at that wind chart. But then you forget that I don't know how to do this. So dealing with the scrutiny that comes with traditional publishing. So you're dealing with a lot of people, from your acquisitions editor to your developmental editor to the marketing and publishing people to the events folks at the bookstores and the reviewers, you know, everybody reading. That's a lot to do. Do you want to deal with the numbers of being a traditionally published writer, where they're doing the numbers and trying to figure out, did you earn out, first of all, and did you make enough money for us to buy more books? And back then, I didn't know what all that meant, because my first book was published and it was through Scribner, which is a Big Ten publisher. And I got into O Magazine and went to the Essence Festival and thought, you know, especially back in 2002, before the internet really was a thing, we all had this vision of what being published was, riding around in the Lincoln Town Cars and having kajillion people at your events and all that. For it to not like really be that, at least for me, and being disappointed with that. Because as a reader, especially, I had this great imagination of what my life would be like. And being disappointed that that's not it. Even for some of the biggest writers, I won't say Stephen King, his life is totally different, but you know, the bigger mid-list writers, they're still cleaning the cat box and doing laundry on Sunday. You know, your life changes, but it doesn't change. And with traditional publishing, that's the dream that you initially kind of buy into, that everything is going to absolutely change for you, when in fact, maybe not. I have friends who had $1 million deals or high six-figure deals, who I thought that life had changed for them, and they haven't earned out. And their publishers aren't interested in the next book because, well, we gave you all that money over there and nothing happened. So that's the other thing. It's like, well, what are the expectations of a traditionally published author? And am I ready to be disappointed and discarded because I didn't live up to what they thought I would?
Oh.
And in my 30s, I had already, you know, I was going through the cancer thing. And I didn't need one more kind of weird stress on me. And, you know, looking back, I'm thankful that I didn't have to have that in addition to everything else to deal with. I could focus on my body. I could first focus on my kid and my husband and, you know, all the rest of what happens in your 30s while also writing and using writing as therapy. I was ready when the time came for that next big publishing contract.
Learning how to temper expectation, confidence, and pressure.
Yeah.
Oh, the anxiety. I'm still learning that one. Where did Fog and Fury come from?
Fog and Fury. So Lou Norton, that series was 4 books, but I didn't do enough that my publisher's like, yeah, let's keep going with this. They said, hey, let's do some standalones. So that was fine. And it wasn't until my Thomas and Mercer publisher, who did my standalone, said, are you interested in going back and doing a procedural? I'm like, yes, I would. So I was thinking about that as I was driving to Mendocino Coast, California, which is near San Francisco. Absolutely beautiful. It's the town based on Murder, She Wrote. It's that cute little town. So I get off at the regional airport in Santa Rosa and I rent a car and I'm going to drive to Mendocino Coast. The highway there was one hairpin curve after another for like 2 hours. And I am a child of Los Angeles. I learned how to drive in LA. The 405 freeway, I know it. So I'm like going in bold and I know how to drive. This highway, I found Jesus like 5 times. It's like curve, 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 curve. And when I finally got there, I was like, I don't think I'm ever going home again because I have to
drive back.
And so it got me thinking, what if I have like a PI character who leaves LA to relocate here and solves crime here? And her journey into this beautiful town is one where she's like, okay, I guess I'm here now. Might as well, you know, do something. And that's where Fog and Fury, the idea, came from. It was that drive. The highway itself, beautiful redwood trees on either side and the Pacific Ocean over there, but also logging trucks and cliffs and all this stuff. It's like, oh, this is a perfect setting, especially someone like me coming from Los Angeles who has all this like highway confidence because I've driven like the freeways, coming into this beautiful town that has secrets and shrouded in this kind of coastal fog. So all this conspired into what Fog and Fury actually became. Absolutely beautiful, though.
So will you please do us the honor of reading something from Fog and Fury so I can ask you about this book?
Yes.
Fog and Fury, a thriller by Rachel Housel Hall, tells the story of former LAPD detective Sunny Rush. She's fled the forest and the City of Angels for a small town up north on the Pacific coast that's just one letter away from heaven. In Haven, Sunny signs up to work as a private investigator with a family friend, and her first case is much less than what she's used to. Until she learns of a teenage football player's death and wonders, what if it's all connected? Here's Rachel.
I will read from the first chapter of Fog and Fury. The fog kept me blind. My scalp prickled with worry sweat as I crept along Pearl Way, the least twisty road in Haven, with the headlights of Fab, my 1970 Ford Bronco, pushing through the mist only to find more mist, driving to my first day as a private investigator in a town of 1,000 people, terrified that I'd end up warped and wrapped around a redwood tree. I'd crept through the fog before, and in the same truck, with the same headlights. But that was in Los Angeles, more than 500 miles south of here. Here, in Haven, I could have driven off a cliff, hit a deer, or slammed into a logging truck. I'd have never seen my end come. Yeah, I may just die here. Too early in the day to be thinking such thoughts, but this fog and this highway, weather was making me hyperbolic. At the same time, was it so strange that a woman who chased a homicidal rapist into the fog and come out of that fog alive, but with a bullet in her shoulder, was acting a little fidgety? In the last 2 years, I clenched Fab's mahogany wood steering wheel so tight, my hands had damn near whittled the wheel into an embroidering hoop. Stress, Dr. Tess Molina had diagnosed. Hell yeah, I'd said. It's Los Angeles, she'd added. The fuck it isn't, I said then. But there I was, driving through a town, 3 square miles big, ocean on one side, forest on the other, still clenching. My cell phone buzzed from the cup holder, but I didn't take my eyes off the road, not until I stopped at one of the 7 traffic signals in Haven. You starting today? 1 million years to drive 1 mile? I tapped a response. You want me there walking or riding in a pine box? Fog getting to you? Yeah, take your time. Not like I was still a homicide detective rushing to a crime scene. Not like there was a cooling body waiting for me to figure out who done it and why. Not like I was driving to notify a family that the worst thing that could ever happen had happened and had happened to them. I no longer had to experience any of this, not anymore. I dropped the phone back into the cup holder and looked to my left. No cars heading northbound on Highway 1. And then to my right, no cars heading southbound. Except for the waves of fog, the 2-lane highway looked clear. And if I wanted, I could have buzzed through that red light, easy peasy. Just my luck, though. Bam, T-boned by a train. A thick cloud rolled around my gut, making me dizzy, but I couldn't close my eyes. My breath grew shallow and fast as my eyes flipped at the rearview and side mirrors. Not that I 100% believed the Suarez family had followed me up here from Los Angeles. Not that I 100% believed their threats. You'll never take another deep breath again. But 9% believing is a hell of a lot. And I watched members of that clan drive slow circles around my car, in parking lots, in the streets around my apartment building. There was nothing stopping them from harvesting the power of fog to reap my breath for the lost breath of their loved one, Autumn. The traffic signal turned green. Wary of monster fog and an angry, grieving family hiding in it, I looked left and right again before spurring the Bronco through the intersection. Once I safely reached the other side of Highway 1, once I saw that no one had pulled up behind me, my damp hands relaxed. Yeah, I may just die here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, When I got the email press release about the book, I was like, a dog napper? What are we doing? I'm not the girl that's into animal stories. Mm-hmm. And so I was like,
yeah,
I don't think about it.
Very intentional.
I know. Uh-huh. Having read the book, oh, I know. The whole last send all.
Yes.
When I got the galley in the mail and I put it in my stacks and I started reading it, I'm like, okay, we ain't here, girl. What's happening? And then everything that happened, I was not prepared for. She doesn't think that she's going to be waiting on a body at the morgue. There's a body waiting for her at the morgue. The dog, the family, the beauty, the fog. It was all most. And then there's the backstory that I still don't know. Was Sunny from another series that I need to go read to find out what happened in L.A.? I'm like, you're dropping scenes and I don't have answers. And I was real pissed. And I'm like,
yes. Yes.
I need to all go find another book.
Now, it's like you, I am not a cozy mystery reader at all. My editor calls my books Cozy's Gone Crazy because I will take the idea of a cozy, cute little town with, you know, an amateur sleuth or a sleuth who has this first case and that's to find a dog. But then I come and it's like, yeah, this town is fucked up. And that dog leads to other bigger crimes. It's just the entryway, because I think life is like that. I think you go to the grocery store and you're in an aisle and then somebody comes in there with a gun. That's what life is to me. Like at this camp in Texas, kids send their kids to a camp. And next thing you know, the whole fucking thing is flooded, because life is like that. And despite your best intentions, you can just be minding your business and your whole world is messed up 20 minutes later. And I write books like that, where it's like, you think you're going to this pretty, pretty town with your first case, where she is annoyed that her first case is finding this missing golden doodle. And little does she know that there are bodies that are connected to that dog, you know? And yeah, so I am very intentional when I write, and whether people pick up on some things or not, that's for them to figure out and go back and say, oh my God, that's what you meant by that. So yeah. Yeah.
See, what I picked up on is like when the football player dies and you're first going over what's in his system, you mentioned the vape and the nicotine. And there's only one character in this whole story that had a vape. And
it was all there.
With all the symptoms trying to get people to think about, no, it's not her. It's that lady.
Yeah, I am very intentional about making sure that the character is always in the very beginnings of the book. The how they done it is in that very kind of first meeting. It's all there. And then you go back. It's like, oh, so she did say it. Oh, so the clue was there. And sometimes for people who kind of know who done it, the mystery for them is the why. Why did this happen?
Yeah.
And so I try to write for both of those audiences.
I think for me, you have this Black woman coming to this lily white town. Unbeknownst to her, she's sleeping with a married man. She thought, you know, his divorce was final. We won't do it. We listen and we don't judge. Right?
Some of the best of us. Some of the best of us.
She goes to this lily white town. Her boyfriend is this married man, very highfalutin, one of the founders. She's having to start over her love life, her personal life with her mother, because her mother has early onset Alzheimer's.
Dementia.
Yeah. But she's used to being a cop. She's used to being in charge. And yet all these dominoes start falling that, as you said, you know, you want to write the Black woman that comes in and disrupts, but it doesn't make her uncomfortable. The dynamics of being the only one there.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, she does have some discomfort, but she kind of keeps it to herself. And Black women especially are, that's what we do. And that's why community is important. We have to go into spaces at work, in the classroom, in government. And sometimes we are the only ones. Are we going to crumple and fold, or are we going to like call on the ancestors and, you know, are really nice shoes to say, I'm just going to power through this. And I know more than everybody in this room, and they expect me to fail, but I will not fail. We have not failed since we were brought over here. And Sunny has that in her. Add to that, being a cop, you can't show fear. You can't like vacillate in the face of danger. And so she's extra, extra crispy in her confidence because she was born that way. And then she was trained to be that way. And what gets to her is the setting. It's the fog, the uncertainty. She's not uncomfortable with knowing that there are evil people there because she was in a city with 4 million people and a high percentage. It's not being able to see them clearly. And that's what troubles her, that here's this so-called perfect town that I was supposed to come in and recreate my life. And my mother's in a fog. This town is in a fog. My relationship with my boyfriend is in a fog. This is unsettling to me. I'm comfortable solving crime, but usually I have some clarity in other places. What happens when you have no clarity anywhere? So she digs into the crime case with some ease, questioning people with some ease, because that's easy to figure out. But doing that when your whole world literally is unclear, that's where she has anxiety. That's where she goes to therapy to talk about guilt and moving on. And even the case that sent her up to Haven, where she showed compassion, that was a cloudy thing. What is my world even? So if she can be confident in something, she will choose to do that. And she does that with her clothes. She does that with her attitude, her confidence in speaking to people. But she has to, if she's going to survive Haven and what Haven has for her. Oh, and even her boyfriend, not even Cooper, his marital status being weird, he's even like hiding. He's like an eighth black, and he's presenting as totally. So even he is unclear in who he is genetically. Mm-hmm. So it's fog everywhere.
And in that fog, you use that, I think, to elucidate what is happening in the world. So you have a black football player who ends up dead and no one knows how, and everyone's quick to close the case. And I immediately thought of Kendrick Johnson down in Georgia. You have a queer couple who were persuaded to come and open a bakery, and one of the husbands is like, yeah, I don't fuck this place, right? Then all the homophobia that they face, the signs and the flag and the burnings and things like that. What is it about mystery, suspense, and thriller that allows you to use a very formulaic kind of prescription for writing to really discuss what's happening in the wider world with a black woman character at the center?
One, I love this genre. I love this community because it is in some ways formulaic. You know, you have to have the sleuth, you know, you have to have the body and the big twist and red herrings and all that. And then the reveal. I like that kind of formulaic thing. It helps me with my checking off list kind of thing. I don't do math well, but I like the math of, you know, that. But I like that any story can be made into a mystery. A romance can be a mystery. Sci-fi can be a mystery. It's very malleable for what your story can be. And also, like I said, I think life is one big mystery. I think we all have plot twists in our life, and I like stories that reflect that. I think even the most boring person won't realize that there is some big mystery in their life. And for me, finding that is fun. Finding why that guy over there would kill his wife is fascinating. I think mystery in this genre allows people to like have know that justice in some ways will be served. Not necessarily closure, but justice. Closure is something completely different. Even if a cop finds and arrests the bad guy and that bad guy is sent to jail forever and ever, my loved one is gone. I can never have closure about that because a space in me has been left void. But I can find justice. That guy's in jail. So mystery allows people to have justice, but not necessarily closure. And in series, especially the next book in the series, Miss Malice, will still have some vestiges and remnants of this first book in it. Because I think even though you go on, you don't. Parts of you are still left behind. So it allows for that. Women like true crime. I watch it at my lunch every day. I'm on, you know, Discovery ID channel because we want to know what the wolves look like. And women talk so that we know and can tell what the wolves look like. And those are the stories that are passed down from generation to generation. And those are crime stories. I mean, the Bible is one big crime book of people doing unto each other that they shouldn't be doing. We've all been introduced to mystery as parts of our lives, what to do and what not to do, what plant to eat, what will happen to you if you eat that mushroom over there. Those are crime stories. Those are things that keep us all alive. So adding a Black woman, a Black character into these things where Black women are always seen as culprits or irritants, pollutants, shit stirrers, just makes the story real for me. Because despite your best abilities, despite all your experience and your goodness and your expertise, we are still seen as less than or not deserving of or something. We are always the bad guy. And, you know, we bring that kind of sensibility into everything we do, knowing that we're being watched. And I like that in this story where there's this powerful Black woman who is a mystery to most of these people coming in and saying, yeah, no, I don't believe you. I think you're a mess. I think this town sucks. I validate the husband who does not want to be here because he's seeing this town in a way that his husband, who's white, is not seeing this town. You know, so she brings in a perspective that no one else has and no one values until now.
You said a while back that what intrigues you is that there is a mystery in everyone's life. So I have to ask, what is the mystery of your life?
One of my books, These Toxic Things, sprung out of a mystery in my life. I wrote These Toxic Things at the start of the pandemic. And if you remember, everybody was Marie Kondoing their lives, looking for, you know, the objects. You keep it, the 3-second rule. And we're cleaning out our closets and looking for meaning and blah, blah, blah. And I'm cleaning out my hallway closet. I, in my family, am the keeper of things. So I have all the stuff. So I'm going through all these files my mom gave me to keep. And there's an envelope in her handwriting. And it says, do not open until after my death. And she's still alive. But it says that. And my husband's like, open it. And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not. Because what is in there? And why can't I open it? And there's a mystery there. And it still remains because she's alive. And I'm not opening that because what is it that she wants to say or wants to give me that she needs me to wait?
Did you ask her about it?
No. No. I don't want to talk about it. But it's those types of things that here I was minding my own Black business stuff, and I find this envelope in here with a woman I talk to all the time, my mother, saying, don't do this until I die. That's a mystery. Everybody has some random thing like that. Like, whose lipstick is this in my car? I'm looking at my bank charges and what's this charge? Am I going to actually, you know, dig into this or am I going to just let it be? So, yeah,
we dispute the bank charges. We dispute the bank charges. You can send me a new credit card.
Right.
You have a card. I'll get the digital one and do Apple Pay.
Right.
Bank charges.
Exactly. So, yeah. 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 Someone shows up at your door and you have no idea if that person is actually the mailman or someone else. You know, so we, through the grace of God, make it to each and every day without having to solve many mysteries, but they're out there and I'm waiting for it to happen. And so I can read it on the news so I can web clip it. And if they write a story about it.
With that said, what are you working on next?
I just turned in the second of the Sunny Rush Haven thriller series, Mist and Malice. And I'm hoping there's going to be a third, Sand and Sorrow, I think I named it, in addition to a few other stories. I am going to bookstores, and my romanticy, the next in a series called The Cruel Dawn, will be out August 19th, and I will be all over the place talking about that book. So I'm everywhere and writing and reading, as always.
All right. So now I want to move to a speed round game before I let you go for the morning. What is your favorite book?
Into Thin Air by John Krakauer.
Who was your favorite author?
Stephen King.
What is your favorite TV show?
The Golden Girls.
Oh. What do you think is the best book to movie or book to series adaptation?
Lord of the Rings.
If Fog and Fury got the movie treatment, who would you want to play Sonny Rush?
Oh, Nicole Barry.
Yeah. If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
You know, we went to the Bahamas for vacation, and I absolutely love that place. Either there or Kauai, the perfect island. And I would write and read and nap and eat with my husband and daughter. And yeah, those are all I need. A pretty place, some books and pens, and food.
Name three things on your bucket list.
I would like to go on a cruise that lasts longer than a week. So maybe a 2-week cruise to somewhere, maybe Alaska or Europe somewhere. Going to one of those restaurants that have like 14 course meals prepared by a top chef, and inviting, you know, 20 of my closest friends. And yeah, I think those two things. After doing the cancer thing, I try and do as much as I can if allowed. But those two things, at least.
What brings you joy?
Making my family smile.
What brings you peace?
Being able to check off everything on my list.
As a type A obsessive, I understand that.
Yeah.
When all of my to-dos are highlighted in my calendar.
With your pen in your hand. Mm-hmm, I see it right now. Mm-hmm.
What author makes you want to burn your notebook?
Toni Morrison.
All right. So that's going to take us into rewriting the classics. Classic is however you define it. Name one book you wish you would have written.
There are two. So Beloved, especially now that I understand it as an adult, mixed with The Stand, Stephen King, which is so big and sprawling and dystopic, but mysterious and biblical in so many ways. So those two big idea books.
Name one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
Back to Stephen King. It would be It, the book with the clown who hides in the sewer with eyes like dimes. It was so good and scary, and it terrified me. And I felt I was seen because I was scared of clowns and sewers as a kid. But Spider at the end? No, that's not how I would want the ending to be. So it would be that.
All right. And then name a book that you think is overrated or overtalked, and why?
You know, one thing about being a writer is hearing the criticism of other people and what they think. And it's hurtful, like going on Goodreads and seeing people giving, you know, 1 and 2 stars and just being gleeful in their awfulness. Mm-hmm. And so even books that, like Colleen Hoover's not my favorite read, but I appreciate what she's done, you know, in craft. It may not be high art, but it does something for those who read her. So I will say that. And hey, she's made a cajillion amount of money. She has a house on the lake and a purple Porsche. And, you know, Lord, do for me what you did for Colleen Hoover. So that's my answer.
My final question for you today. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
I would like people to know that I worked my tail off to tell what I thought was the truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, through my stories, through my life, that I worked hard. Yeah. I turned over every rock that I could.
Big thank you to Rachel Housel Hall for being here today on Black and Published. You can follow Rachel on the socials at Rachel Housel Hall on Instagram and Threads. And make sure you check out Fog and Fury, out now from Thomas and Mercer. you can get a copy of the book from Mahogany Books and get 10% off your first purchase using code BLACKPUB at checkout. That's BLKPUB. And if you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Rachel about why she believes writers must be readers and why she's grateful for her day job to keep her story ideas fresh. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. That's our show for the week and season. I'll holler at y'all next year for season 6, premiering January 6, 2026. Because you know, I do have a book coming out next year. And I'll be back to tell you how I wrote it, how I finally got my agent, and how we sold it to my editor in 7 days. There's much to discuss. I'll talk to you then. Peace.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.